Well, sure is good to be with you this morning. I love to study the Word of God, and I love to teach the Word of God. And to folks such as yourself that are Bible teachers and elders and gospel preachers, it is a joy. Thank you for coming. Thank you for the invitation. Good to see the elders again here at Eastside. It's been a long time since I've seen some of you, and as well as other visitors that have come and fellow gospel preachers. It's good to be with you. Both Steve and Alan have traveled with me to Israel just recently, in fact, and so I appreciate that. I don't know that anyone else here has done that yet, but we'll see how that goes for future reference, maybe. When I was asked to deal with the subject of Bible geography and its relation to biblical studies, there's so much. At this point, I've been privileged to go to all the places where it specifies that Paul preached, except for into Syria and Arabia, which it doesn't say he preached in Arabia. It says he went there for 3 years. He did preach in Damascus. I've not been to Damascus, but all the other places that Paul preached, as well as all the way to the upper Mesopotamian Valley, into the border of Syria, to the border of Iran, and all over Turkey and Greece and Italy, and many of the islands. And so it's when I was first asked to do this, it's like, well, how do you narrow it down? Because again, I've been privileged to have many opportunities and have at this point tens of thousands of photos of the Bible lands. So here's what I decided on. What I decided on is lesson number one is to talk about the setting of the biblical world and just talk about a lot of the things that will help us in terms of not just Israel, but the biblical lands and more than the lands, to even touch on other things that will help us in understanding the biblical world. Then for the second period, I want to specifically deal with the first and second journeys of Paul and just travel with him and show how that not only the use of maps but of good photos of the Bible lands helps us to understand, visualize the events that are taking place. Back at Hanceville, year-round we have a young people's class, and the young people hear me on a regular basis say, because we know their faith will be under attack. Their faith is under attack and will be as time goes on. But I want to fortify their faith, and one way you can do that is to reinforce the fact that when you read the Bible and read about places and people and events, these are real places, real people. The events really happen. It's fact, not fiction. It's true history. It's inspired. You can trust the Bible. And so I don't have to see a place to believe it. And yet the more we can learn, and that includes sometimes seeing the places, it helps us to visualize the text. And in our learning and in the way God has made our minds, the more things we can cross-reference and associate with a topic, then so much the better. Well, as Steve said, we have a lot to cover. So the thing to notice is that the events of the Bible itself, even if you look at the not just Israel, but the larger picture, it's still a relatively small part of the globe. And then when you specifically deal with the Old Testament period and the time of the patriarchs, this is going to include Mesopotamia, where Abraham was from, as well, of course, the land of Israel that he was promised and to which he traveled, the land of Canaan. And so, and as you see on this map, you're seeing largely the Mediterranean world, and you think in terms of New Testament times and the world of that day, that, of course, is going to be very important. When you look at the land of Israel itself, and, you know, may I interrupt myself to say it's so good to see Sister Lee this morning, and I'd already purposed to say this, that back in the 80s, everybody here knows Bob and Sandra Waldron. Of course, they lived and preached here for a number of years. And otherwise, everybody, I mean, you can't find anybody that's not studied from their books and learned from them. But back in the 80s, when they were at Hanceville, they were working on their book that came to be the History and Geography of the Bible. And I was already interested in things like that, had been for a number of years. I'd studied archaeology in college. And but to see what Bob and Sandra were doing by research of the Bible lands really not just ignited the fire. The fire was there, but it flamed the interest that I had. And so, for example, this is a map that Bob and Sandra came up with right here in terms of showing the physical features of the land. Just knowing things like that are important in terms of why people lived where they did, where you could grow crops, what places might not have been as inhabitable. So the longitudinal zones, the coastal region, the Shephelah, the central hill country, the Jordan Valley, this rift goes all the way down, the Red Sea and all the way into Africa, you see, the Great Rift. And then on the other side, the Transjordan Plateau. And so those are features of the land that are very important as you study the scriptures and will be helpful to you in understanding a lot of things. The land of Canaan, of course, named for a descendant, a grandson of Noah. Israel's called the Promised Land because it was promised to Abraham. Called the land of Israel because, of course, Jacob's name changed to Israel, and so the name of the person is given to the name of the land. Sometimes it's called Palestine. More often, this was the name given by the Romans. And it's a derivative of the name of the word Philistine. That's where that comes from. And by the way, Canaan itself just referred to the west side of the Jordan River. That was the Promised Land. You know, you stop and think about that for a minute. Moses went to the land of Abel Shittim in the plains of Moab, so he was on the eastern side of the Jordan River, but he didn't go to the Promised Land. He couldn't cross over. So Canaan was just the west side, whereas Palestine, that term refers to both sides of the Jordan River. So again, when we focus just on the land of Israel itself, the region from Dan to Beersheba is only about 150 miles. That's not that far. And yet it's big enough for God's people to live, for them to have their home, for the 12 tribes to receive their allotment, and it's big enough for so much of the activity Old and New Testament you read about in the Scripture to happen right there. Not nearly everything, but so much of it. For example, in the ministry of Jesus, except for his going to the region in the area of Tyre and Sidon, Jesus' ministry is confined to this area that we're looking at right here. I believe we bumped the volume up. I can hear me now. Brother Ralph, I guess you can really hear me now. I asked you a while ago if you could. Okay, so the thing about the land of Israel, and by the way, Steve, as I mentioned this, I'm not approaching this as if you all don't know this. I know for some of you, I'm reviewing some things. For others, you may not know. But for all of us, we need to be impressed, and we learn by review. And so the land of Israel is a strategic location. Even today, it's considered a very strategic strip of land because it is a land bridge that connects three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. And so this is the land bridge, a sea of water to the west, a sea of sand to the east. And so this is a land bridge. I have an atlas in my library that is entitled The Sacred Bridge. And it's called that for a reason. So again, a strategic location. When you section the land of Israel itself, to the north, the highest point here is Mount Hermon. You're looking again at the great rift that comes on down. When you get to the Sea of Galilee, you're already about 696 feet below sea level. It's called the Sea of Galilee, but it's fresh water. But again, you're looking here at Galilee, the hills of Galilee, the land of Bashan to your east. Coming on down, you see the rift widens, the Jordan Valley here. Again, the coastal plain, the hill country, the central hill country of Samaria, and again, the Transjordan. And here you see the Dead Sea. Now, by the way, I on Friday afternoons, ordinarily I teach some real brilliant homeschoolers. They're my daughter's children. Just happened to be. But I teach Bible and history on Friday afternoons. And in the history, they were dealing with more recent history of Ethiopia And it was making the point in Ethiopia where the land, where the great rift is, that the land there, that spot is the lowest point on the earth's surface. Boy, what an egregious error. Actually, you can talk about the lowest point in Ethiopia. I don't deny that, but the Dead Sea is the lowest point on the earth's surface. In other words, the land surrounding that. You're looking really at, as the sea has receded really right now, about 1,300 feet below sea level. They used to say 300. The sound, it seems like it's going off and on. Am I doing something? Okay. All right. Okay. It's unnerving me, but I'm okay. Don't worry about me. I'll be all right. So here we have it, and again, this is if you were to section the sea, look at the Negev. That's a Hebrew word, just means south. So you've got the south, Beersheba, of course, being the most southern point right there. Hills of Moab, Ruth, you know, was from here. So you start to associate things, events with the places. Okay, you recognize that? That's Joppa. What we're going to do now, it was Hester that wrote the book, The Heart of Hebrew History. Wasn't that his name? And one of the points he makes in his book is that there's no place on earth that has the variety that the land of Israel does in the same amount of territory. And so I want to talk about the variety of the land right now. For example, right here, obviously you're looking at sea level. Of course, the temptation for me is to pause and say, well, Joppa, you know, this is where Jonah got on a ship to try to run away from God. Joppa, this is where the cedars from the land of Lebanon were floated down in rafts and then taken here and then overland to Jerusalem. Joppa, this is where Dorcas was raised from the dead in Acts 9. Joppa, that's where Peter was in Acts 10 when Cornelius sent for him. But now see, if I do that on all these places, we'll never get through. So right now we're just talking about the variety. So this is Joppa. It is right on the Mediterranean Sea. You can still see the ruins of the ancient harbor, by the way. Joppa was a very ancient city. Tel Aviv is just to the north of Joppa. You can actually see Tel Aviv when you're at Joppa, just looking right up the coast. So you move inland just 35 miles, and now you are 2,500 feet above sea level at Jerusalem. And always when the Bible speaks of one's going to Jerusalem, he goes up to Jerusalem. And it doesn't matter what direction you're going, like it's going to say in Acts chapter 8, that Philip, who was at Jerusalem, it'll say he went down to the city of Samaria. Well, he's going north, but you go down when you depart from Jerusalem. You go up, so it's altitude, not direction, the Bible speaks of. So that's Jerusalem, and here again, first mentioned in Genesis 14, and then throughout Scripture, Melchizedek, priest of Salem, priest of Jerusalem, and king of Elyon, God Most High. So here we are at Jerusalem, the city over which Jesus wept, the city where Jesus was crucified. But we move our way another 14 miles here to the east, a little bit north, and we come to Jericho. In Deuteronomy 34 in verse 3, Jericho is called the city of palm trees. And even today, as you look at the environs of Jericho, when you leave Jerusalem, go down the Mount of Olives and you keep going down, at Jericho you're 800 feet below sea level. Did your ears pop, Steve, as you felt that? So it's a decline in altitude. Your ears will pop 800 feet below sea level. But between the Mount of Olives and Jericho, unless there are seasonal rains, it's just desert everywhere, just desert, the desert of Judea. But when you get to Jericho, there are several oases, and the water provides for not only people to live there, but they grow all kinds of things at Jericho. So again, mentioned this is the first city, Joshua chapter 6, that Israel took at the conquest and mentioned so many times. By the way, you may or may not know this, but New Testament Jericho was about a mile to the south of Old Testament Jericho. New Testament Jericho was not built on the same site that ancient Jericho was, so bear that in mind as well. And incidentally, in this photo, in the distance, you're seeing the hills of Moab. You're looking across the Jordan Valley. If you want to know from here to the Jordan River, how far is it? The answer is 6 miles. But see, the visibility you have, you can see people coming. And so this, again, is Jericho. Now, we go to the south, just a little bit south of Jericho, and here you come to the lowest point on the face of the earth. You're really looking at about 1,300 feet now below sea level. This water is salty, several times saltier than seawater. It is very buoyant. If you can't swim, this is a great place to go swimming, because you couldn't drown accidentally. I mean, I guess you could commit suicide, you know, just put your face down, breathe in on purpose. I suppose I've never heard of anybody doing that there. But I mean, you'll see people lying flat on their back reading or having something to drink while they're out there. It's really funny. But this is the Dead Sea. Again, you can see right across to the hills of Moab on the other side. Now, I'll tell you an interesting thing about my friend Bob Waldron. You know, one of the things that he said in his book, and Bob would be okay with me telling this because he and I have talked about this. But in his book, he's talking about this region right here and at the Dead Sea. And in the book, he said, it never rains in this part of the world. Well, you see the glimmer right here? That is the Dead Sea. Can you see what this is here? That's a rainbow. Now, Eli Ben Mir, who died in, I think, 2014, he directed a tour. He was our local guide on a tour that I took in 2013, and he died just a few months later. But he told me that in all the trips and all the groups, he lives in Israel, and all the times he's been to the Dead Sea and taken groups there, he said that is the only time in his lifetime that he had ever seen a rainbow over the Dead Sea. So you're getting to see something you don't usually see. So the thing is, it doesn't usually rain here, but sometimes it does. I've been there a couple of times when it rained. But, of course, the water can be up at Jerusalem. It can be raining there, and the Kidron Brook comes on down, makes its way to the south and to the east, and empties into the Dead Sea. So it can rain in Jerusalem, and still water will be downstream later, you see. But anyway, so you see the kind of variety we're talking about. We're only 50 miles inland, but we've gone from sea level to 2,500 feet above sea level to 800 feet below, and now 1,300 feet below sea level. And now we go to the north, to the Jordan River, the most famous river in the world. McGarvey, in his book of sermons, has a sermon just on the Jordan River. I've never done that yet, but he's got a sermon just on the Jordan River. And Brother McGarvey makes the point that this is the most famous river in the world. But it's not famous for the reasons that make other rivers famous. Other rivers are famous because of their usefulness in navigation. Jordan is not navigable. Other rivers are famous because of their size, but the Jordan River is not a large river. A third reason that other rivers are famous is because of great cities that are built on their shores. Jordan has no significant cities built on their shores, and yet here's the most famous river in the world, and it's because of the Bible. It's because of the events that happened here. It's because Jesus was baptized in the Jordan. John baptized in the Jordan. Israel crossed the Jordan to get to the promised land. Naaman received cleansing when he dipped 7 times in the Jordan. It's because of the Bible and events that happened here that this is the most famous river in the world. By the way, where I took this photo is just to the south of the Sea of Galilee. This is the Sea of Galilee. We're on the western side, and on a clear day you can see forever. Again, depending on the drought conditions, like a lake here, it depends what the level is. Going to depend if you got a drought or if you got a lot of rain here lately. So So you'll see an atlas that'll say the Sea of Galilee is 8 miles across. That's probably at optimal level. It'll be 7.5 or maybe even 7 if it's a drought condition. So, but anyway, you're looking across about 8 miles across here. And incidentally, if you're talking about the time when the on the Decapolis side, when the owners of the swine were going to be very dismayed because the swine became possessed by the demons. It came out of the man who was called Legion, and they rushed down the steep part of the bank and into the sea, and they were drowned. And so you're looking at that area where that happened. I could say that's the first recorded case of deviled ham. But I won't say that. But again, this is the area. So you're teaching on that, and here's a visual to see the area where that was, and again, the swine running down as the Bible says. And the people asked Jesus to leave there, and he did. I never tire of seeing sunrise at the Sea of Galilee. And, you know, I'll tell you, of course, Brother Olin Britnell back there, he knows about this. He's traveled many times to the Bible lands. But I'm sure people have mentioned to him, and maybe some of you others who have gone, that I wouldn't want to go because things have changed so much since then. You know, nothing would be like it was in the days of Christ. Well, a lot of things have changed. Buildings come and go, that sort of thing. But the geographical features, the Sea of Galilee. If you're on the western side of the Sea of Galilee and you watch the sunrise, how would this be any different than when Jesus was on earth and saw the sunrise? I mean, you're seeing what he saw. You're seeing what the apostles did. And they saw that a lot because they lived here a lot and they ministered here a lot. And so, by the way, in the Bible, they would fish during the night and early in the morning bring their fish in. And even today when there's fishing, now there are seasons that there's no fishing, but when the fishermen are allowed to fish, they still fish at night and then bring their fish in early in the morning. And that's what's going on right here. This person's been fishing during the night, and he's bringing in, you can probably, I imagine what you're seeing here are the nets that are kind of rolled up. So anyway, that's the setting of the Sea of Galilee. And just to the north here, you have that highest point in the land. This is Mount Hermon. And there are times that it's snow-capped, but not all year round. I read somewhere where somebody said it's snow-capped all year round. That's not true. Now, Mount Ararat is snow-capped all year round, but not Mount Hermon. Sometimes it is, much of the time. But you can go times when you won't see snow. So, I'm remembering that early on in this series here at Eastside that someone did Mount Carmel. Who was that did that? Did you do that, Steve? Brother Stacy did that. And so I'm gonna show you some things probably you've already seen right there. Is Stacy here this morning? Oh, too bad. Okay. Sometimes people ask, what is your favorite place to go? Well, that's a hard one. That's like saying, which is your favorite child or grandchild? I guess they all are. But I've got a lot of favorite places in Israel, but Mount Carmel, would you agree that that's a place, Alan, would you agree? I mean, that is a special place. You can just see so much from there. And where we are, we're standing in 1 Kings 18, where the contest took place with Elijah and the Baal prophets. That was really right behind where we're standing as we look down across the valley of Esdraelon. You can see all that. And when you're looking right along in here, tree line, you're seeing the Kishon that is mentioned, where after the contest he killed the Baal prophets. That actually flows out to the Mediterranean there, so you can see that. You can see a lot from there. We're still at Mount Carmel, and you can see, for example, right here on this slope right here, that's where Nazareth is. And remember, it says in Luke 4 that when they were offended in Jesus, they took him on the brow of the hill on which the city was built and were going to push him off the city. Well, see, that would help you to see what we're talking about, that to push him down from a height like that was really their intent. By the way, behind that, you can see the conical-shaped mountain. That is Mount Tabor, and that's mentioned in Judges chapter 5. That's where Barak and his armies were battling. I said Judges 5, really Judges 4 and 5. Mentioned that. Judges 5 is the Song of Deborah that celebrates it. Judges 4 tells about the battle. And you move just a little bit to the east, to the south, as you're looking here, and you're looking at the hill of Moreh. In Judges chapter 7, this is where Gideon and the Midianites and Gideon's 300 men were going to be facing off. That's the setting for that. And it'll say, by the way, that the Midianites were encamped in the valley on the north side of the mountain. So when you're teaching that, you see, you can say, here's the north side right here, down in here is where they were camped. You can actually make use like that. And then you see a pass right is here, and this is the pass that goes to Gilead. For example, when you're teaching in 2 Kings about Jehu that comes over and he's going to kill King Joram as well as Ahaziah, it turns out as his commission is to wipe out the house of Baal, well, see, that's where he came from, riding from this side, coming around here to Jezreel right there. So that'll make sense. That's the pass. And by the way, the Syrians, like Ben-Hadad, they wanted to control the territory to the east of this because if you control that, you've got a straight shot from there to the Mediterranean. See, right where we are this way. So that's why Syria wanted that. They wanted control and access to the sea. But as we again looked, we're just kind of turning clockwise. Do you have the feel for what we're doing? We're standing at Mount Carmel, and Uncle Ed, Brother Brand, he's been with me too. I failed to mention that a while ago. So, but it was on an earlier trip. It's been long enough, I've almost forgotten. But here you are. Yeah, I mean, you've stood here too. And you turn to the south again, and you're seeing here, remember what mountain that is? No. We're past Moreh, and we got the pass to Gilead. And now we're looking to the south of that. Nope. Who said it? Gilboa. There you go. So you're here, you are, you're turning along, and you come to 1 Samuel 31. And you read about Saul's death. And then you turn again another page to 2 Samuel 1, and you read about David's lamentation. He says, tell it not in Gath. Publish it not among the Philistines, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. He was very saddened, and so he taught Israel the song of the bow. And there's a curse pronounced upon Mount Gilboa. So you can see that from Mount Carmel. And so looking down, we just kind of look down something closer because we've seen a tell down there. Anybody remember what that tell is? See, I've told you, Alan, you can't get it all in one trip. You understand that? Now, I would be surprised if anybody except Olin Britton knew about this one. Do you know what this one is, Olin, you can see from Mount Carmel? No, it's not Megiddo. We're still at Carmel. We're right at Carmel. This is, we're looking right down at our, right below us here. Pardon me? In Joshua, when it tells the conquest, in Joshua 12 and verse 22, it mentions Jokneam. This is Jokneam. And you say, well, why would that have any significance? Take the time, get down your Zondervan Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia or some other reference and look up biblical Jokneam. And it will say that in biblical times, this was a very important city, and it is located on the international highway known as the Via Maris. Because when the coastal route came to this point, it's hitting against Mount Carmel, and so it has to make a turn. And this is where it turned. Now, all those cities in Joshua 12, and it mentions 31 cities and 31 kings. And it's not like these are villages. It's not like these are towns. These are significant strategic places. And that's why it's saying this is what they captured. So, but here again, if you were teaching the conquest, How would you make use of this? Well, you'd have those pictures of Jericho. You'd have places like that, and you could even include this. Or if you're studying in the Kings and the divided kingdom, you can see how useful it would be to go to Mount Carmel and see this sort of thing. But that gives it significant, you know, significance. It's just mentioned that one time, but it was biblically speaking an important city, and that's what we want to do. We want to step into that biblical world, so that it's meaningful to us. When I read a passage, I don't want it just to be a word calling out a word. I want it to be meaningful, and all that I can learn about it, I want to know about it. And I know that's the way you are as students and as teachers. So what we're doing is we're still at Mount Carmel, and we're turning a little bit more, and we're seeing some more hills. This is the hill country of Samaria. And see, knowing this will make sense of 1 Kings 20 when there's a battle with the Syrians and Israel. And the Syrians are trying to figure out how in the world were we defeated. Our army was so much bigger and their army was smaller. And we had a coalition, what was it, 31, 32 kings all together. And how did this happen? So they're having a meeting and somebody says, "Why didn't we think of this before? I know what it is. Their God is a God of the hills. We'll get them down in the valleys and we'll have a battle and then we'll whip them." God sent a man of God back to Ahab, and it's not because Ahab was a good man, because he wasn't, but it's for the glory of God. He says, "Get your army ready. There'll be another battle and the Syrians will know that I'm the God of the valleys also." But you're teaching on that, and you say, "Well, see, this is the central hill country. When those words were spoken there, this is where the most of Israel lives. Samaria, the city, is the capital, and these are the hills of Samaria. That's where the populace was, and so their idea is their God is contained to these hills of Samaria. But if we pitch the battle outside of this area, then we can win." And so, again, this is a case where geography will help you make sense of that. And again, the hill country of Samaria. And we haven't moved. We're still turning around. And what you're seeing here is the Mediterranean Sea. So all of that you can see from Mount Carmel. It's kind of like being at Mount Nebo on the other end. You know, when Moses could see so many things from Mount Nebo, up at Mount Carmel on the north side, you can just see so many things. And here you are, you can have your Bible and a notepad and say, "Well, this happened there, and I see where that happened." And that's really what you're doing from that location, just a number of significant Old Testament and New Testament events right there at Mount Carmel. We're talking about the setting of the biblical world. So, talking about setting, let me mention to you a few more things. Now, I did this up at Paducah in Lafayette, Indiana. Not this exact lesson, but I had some slides that are credited to Biblical Archaeology Review, which I abbreviate with BAR. And Alan Yater, of course, was the gospel preacher up there at that time, and he said, "You probably should tell people what they stand for, so people don't, what those letters stand for, so people don't think you got those photos out of a bar." Well, I hadn't thought about that, but that's Biblical Archaeology Review. And so I have a few that I'm including that I purchased from them. But, for example, do you know what you're looking at here? Somebody says flowers. But you're teaching Amos 5 and verse 7. And Amos refers in the 8th century B.C. to those that turn justice into wormwood. What does that mean to you? You're looking at wormwood. See these shrubs here? That is biblical wormwood. Very bitter. So righteousness should be desired and should be a delightful thing, but you've turned it into something that is distasteful and people don't like it. You don't want righteousness. You've turned righteousness into wormwood. The shittim tree, the acacia tree, furniture from the tabernacle, boards from the tabernacle, for the tabernacle, were made from this kind of tree. I have a real bad habit of not wanting people to be in my photos, not wanting distractions in my photos. But before I took this picture, there was a family that had driven a car under the shade of this tree. And but I don't know if I didn't take any or anyway, I've, the ones that I have used don't have anything. But what Linda says is if you have people there or some other object, it gives you a sense of scale. Because, well, like Donnie here has all his experience as a lumberman. But I remember standing under this and looking at it and thinking of sections of logs you could cut out and how you could make boards from that. You can't tell that much about it just looking here. But this was an enormous tree. This, by the way, is in the wilderness of Sinai. And it would be in this area where Israel traveled. But that tree is mentioned a number of times. So again, if you're teaching on the tabernacle or any number of times when the acacia is mentioned, you could make use of that. I mentioned Deborah a while ago in Deborah chapter 4. Is it verse 5? Right along in there it mentions she sat under a palm tree judging Israel. The date palm tree, which is useful for food. And the branches are woven into baskets or made into mats. But she sat under a palm tree. She's not like Samuel, who of whom it said as a judge later that he made a circuit and went about. But she sat under a palm tree. Israel came to her for judgment. She's not like the other judges that led the army. She deferred to Barak. So even I thought of her when Paul talks about being in subjection as also saith the law, that even though she is a prophetess, that there are principles of subjection that she was governed by in her work. But again, the palm tree, the date palm tree. When I go to Israel, I have lots of dates. I was talking with Linda this morning telling, by the way, she did what I sometimes do. She double booked. She was planning on going and realized that a thing that she thought was tomorrow was today. And so she had another prior commitment. But anyway, we were talking. I was telling her the approach I was going to make. And she was talking about how that animals you read about in the Bible, you're thinking one thing, but it was really something else. And the same thing is true of sometimes of plants and trees. In Alabama, we know about the sycamore tree. But when Amos says in Amos 7 and verse 14 that he was not a prophet or a son of a prophet, that he was a shepherd, he was a tender of sycamore trees, he's not talking about the Alabama sycamore tree. He's talking about this kind of sycamore tree that produces figs. It's not the best fig. It was eaten by the poorer people in the land. But this is the biblical sycamore tree. Speaking of good figs, these I photographed in Corinth, and I know I'm up close, but these were big figs. They grow some big figs there. And dried figs. These figs have really served a useful purpose. I photograph them. I show them everywhere. I also ate them. So they gave me nourishment, which is why I stand before you here this morning, healthy and whole. So they were really good figs. So much is said about the olive tree. Again, these are, and the pomegranate. Now, let me make a suggestion if you want to give your wife a compliment. Song of Solomon 4 and verse 3. Your temple is like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. You say that, it will melt her heart. I mean, just get ready for a warm embrace. It works. So, but the pomegranate, good for food, good for poetry. Oh, how many times do you read about the fruit of the vine in the Bible? Everyone dwelling under his own vine and his fig tree is an expression denoting security, happiness, prosperity, having your needs met. The fruit of the vine, we think in terms of the Lord's Supper. By the way, I photographed these at Bethpage, which is where the Lord was when he descended to ride on the triumphal entry. And these I photographed in Laodicea. There are just a lot of vineyards there. But some of that's so much for the flora, but the fauna. You remember in Numbers 30, let's see. Hold on a minute. Numbers 23 and verse 22. How that Balaam, as he put himself in a position because of his love of the hire of wrongdoing, he put himself in a position that he would bring a curse of calamity upon the armies of Israel, but the Spirit of God took over and God turned the curse into a blessing. So what came out of his mouth was that Israel has the strength of a wild ox. Now, when I think of a wild ox without some help, this is not what would have come to my mind. But this is the biblical wild ox. Or in Deuteronomy 14 and verse 5, when the list of clean and unclean animals is given, and it mentions the antelope. Now, I've been reading Outdoor Life, you know, since I was a kid. I know about hunting antelope out in Wyoming and what antelope look like. That's not the biblical antelope. This is the antelope. In fact, the NIV, perhaps some other translations, will say desert antelope. But this is the animal that's mentioned there as a clean animal that you could eat. And also the deer in the same text, Deuteronomy 14 and verse 5. Which, had I been living then, I would have thought that is a good thing. You know, to appreciate the finer things of life, to enjoy venison. I'm always disturbed when people say that they don't like deer meat. But it's good, and it's approved, it's clean, back then and now. Let's see, Psalm 104, verse 18, the high hills are for the wild goats. This is the wild goat of the Bible. By the way, this is at, let's see, what is the site here just south of Qumran and Gedi, which means spring of the wild goats. Also at Engedi, you see the rock badger. They're mentioned in Proverbs 30. By the way, these were not clean animals because though they chewed the cud, they did not have a forked hoof. But they are mentioned as people that make their crags and that make their home in the crags of the rocks. As you can see, that's what they do. In Jeremiah chapter 8 and verse 7, God says, even the stork knows its appointed time. But my people do not know the statutes of the Lord. Isn't that amazing? The stork takes its migration when it's supposed to, just does what it's supposed to do. But people made in the image of God refuse to do what God has said. So many references are made to the camel. I've seen a lot of camels in the Bible lands. These were kind of scrawny looking ones, but they're also in Sinai. And this is near some Bedouin. The donkey, again, mentioned a number of times in Scripture. And again, in Matthew 25, the sheep, the goats will be on the left hand. These are some biblical goats, and the sheep on the right. And again, so many times in Bible lands, you'll be privileged to see that. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, these just look like regular old cows. And I know that's true, but these are not just any cows. When they moo, they have an Israeli accent. Now, I photograph, and I think in terms of Psalm 50, where the Lord says, the cattle on 1,000 hills are mine. But in Joshua 19, when the allotment of the land is being given, it mentions Beit Lechem, Bethlehem. This Bethlehem is up in Galilee. And I photographed these cattle at that Bethlehem. You see, Micah the prophet had foretold that Bethlehem Ephrathah, Micah 5 and verse 2, would be the place Jesus would be born. There was more than one Bethlehem. There is specificity on the exact location. There is more than one Bethlehem. So he said the one in Judah. And that's, of course, exactly where Jesus was born. Well, let's see here. We've looked at Israel itself, the variety in the land. We've looked at its flora and its fauna. And now let's look at its neighbors. And we start to the north and west at Mesopotamia. And I was privileged to be in Upper Mesopotamia. Actually, I took this shot about 10 years ago. At the time, they were constructing a dam. And everything you see here is going to be underwater when that is completed. But this is the Tigris River, and another location here in Upper Mesopotamia of the Tigris River. It's smaller than the Euphrates. This is the Euphrates River. Another shot of that near Zigma. the Euphrates River. But these two rivers define Mesopotamia. In fact, Mesopotamia means the land between the rivers. So those are the two biblical rivers. And do any of you have the old Baker's Bible Atlas? This was a textbook at FC years ago, may still be. But from that source, I copied this black and white map that, again, is showing the Fertile Crescent. And you see, this defines where people could live. And again, the Tigris. And today, you see, these have their origin in Turkey here. Really, this is southeastern Turkey. This is Mount Ararat right there where I'm pointing. But they have their origin really in Turkey, making their way on down the Euphrates, the Tigris, and coming down, of course, to the Persian Gulf. You've got the Orontes River and, of course, the Jordan River. But this is where people could live. That's why that became known as the Fertile Crescent. So, again, you've got Mesopotamia. And when you think about that, these are the civilizations of Nineveh, Babylon, again, so much in the Old Testament. And even in Acts chapter 2, when it talks about those present on the day of Pentecost, it'll include dwellers from Mesopotamia. So, again, the Israel's neighbors. Of course, that's going to refer to the dispersion when it mentions that. And in the Arabian desert, in the days of the New Testament, the capital of Arabia, of the Nabataeans, was Petra. And have you heard of the Silk Road, the Silk Highway that went right through Petra and continuing to go west from there till it hit the International Highway? This is the best preserved of the ancient high places. That is at Petra. So next we come on down to Sinai. And so if you're talking about that period of wilderness wandering for 40 years, you can show the terrain in Sinai. This is on the southern part here. But again, have you ever wondered why it will mention, for example, in Exodus 17, as they were traveling along there, that they came, it says, to 12 springs and 70 palm trees. Have you ever wondered why that something like that's in the Bible? If you've been marching day after day in desert, and you see greenery, you see foliage up ahead, you know there's water up there. And you're marching in hot, burning sand. We've sung that song, but as I was in this area and along the Red Sea before leaving that area, I wanted to go and get some water from the Red Sea to show the kids in our young people's class. And I took my shoes and socks off and walked on out into the sea and got some of the water from the Red Sea. And got back to the little minivan that we were in. That was not a tour. That was just a personal trip that I made it. And my daughter accompanied me. Got there and trying to get the sand off. And the skin on the bottom of my feet was burned off just in that short time I was walking on the sand. Hot, burning sand. So you get to the palm trees, you'd count them, every one. You're just so glad to see them. But you see, this is the kind of terrain we're walking in. And the point of it is, God is going to say through Moses, you remember that in that time your feet didn't swell. And God gave you water out of the rock. And it was a place of fiery serpents. It was a dry and thirsty land. So it's in this kind of land that God kept his people. As the men of war died, he preserved his people, passing through here again, the wilderness of Sinai. But we come to Egypt. You know what I'm doing, don't you? I'm fighting the clock. You feel my pain? Donnie knows me a long time. I've always fought the clock, but especially on a lesson like this. In Egypt, by the way, you're right here at Memphis, the ancient capital of Egypt, which today is just almost nothing there. But in ancient times, this was a very powerful and very large and highly populated city, just to show you a little bit about that. The Giza pyramids, the oldest pyramid in the world is this one, the Step Pyramid. These are the two largest pyramids. This is the Great Sphinx built by Pharaoh Khafre. Of course, the Nile River. If you're talking about the 10 plagues and the Nile River turning to blood, it'd be good to have a visual like this to just think about that time. That, you know, the fish died and they couldn't drink of the water. Even today, by the way, this is the source of drinking water for Egypt. I mean, you'd expect that. But that's the source of the whole civilization of Egypt is the Nile River. But as we make our way to the north, in Old Testament times, this is the Hittite Empire, the capital was right here at Hattusis. This is the Halys River that largely defined the center of power, but all of this would have been under the sway of the Hittite Empire. Let me show you there. That's the Halys River. And this is at Hattusha, the great temple there. Again, a thriving civilization. It's possible today to get a doctoral degree in Hittite studies. Did you know that? There's so much information on the ancient Hittites. But again, as we wrap this up, the Apostle Paul in the New Testament is going to say that he preached the gospel from Jerusalem to Illyricum, and is prepared to preach to those of you in Rome also. And of course, this is going to be the setting of much of our study in this next period coming up. What I do sometimes, if I have time here, is to talk about the setting of the biblical world in terms of its religious setting. And Steve, let me defer to you. I could either take a couple of minutes to do this, or I could stop right now and just see if there's any questions. It's okay. Have you ever wondered why God said through the prophet Elijah in 1 Kings 17 that there will be no water or dew, not just water, no water or dew till I say so? It's because the people said that Baal controlled the rain. The storm god, Baal, Hadad, depending on what language or what country, but he controls the water, this fertility god. And so you worship him, he gives you rain, he blesses your crops. And this is why the contest took place in 1 Kings 18 that showed they could call on Baal all day long. There's no answer. When Elijah, the servant of God, called upon God, then there is water. He controls the water. But again, Baal is widely worshipped. Oftentimes a hand is up like it is here, and he would be holding a thunderbolt. That was the imagery of Baal. So again, so many passages that talk about that. See, all the nations, all the peoples had their gods. We don't know how strange it was, because we know idolatry is wrong. We memorize the commandment that says, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make unto thee any graven image." When God said that in the world, in the biblical world, in all that paganism, that more than any one thing set Israel apart as being distinct and different from everybody else. And so just to step into that world for just a moment, for example, at Egypt, at the funerary complex of Hatshepsut, who is likely, by the way, the woman that raised Moses. But you see here Hathor, the face of a woman and the ears of a cow. I really hope that doesn't look like anybody you know. She's widely worshipped. The sacred bull, the Apis bull, back in the background here, that's Serapis right there. I shot these at Alexandria in Egypt. Bes is the god for expectant mothers. The falcon god, Horus, represented the deified pharaoh. That is, after death. And for example, Khafre that built the great sphinx. Here, this is in the Egypt Museum. And you see on his shoulder is Horus. Now, if you didn't know what I just told you, you might think, well, he must have liked birds. Or this was his pet. But the significance of that is that this is suggestive of the deity of the pharaoh. You see, Horus is the god. And so that's the connection there. The Colossi of Memnon, there are two of these, guarded the entrance at the Valley of the Kings. This, by the way, if I were teaching on Daniel, you could use this, because this was 60 feet tall. And that image that his three friends were commanded to worship was another 30 feet higher than that in Daniel 3. But again, it gives you a visual to help people see what we're talking about that is mentioned in the text. And talking about the biblical world, at Hazor in Egypt, this is where Baal was worshipped, this complex right here. In fact, that's the standing stone there by which Baal was worshipped. And everybody knows about Dan and Jeroboam making that false system at Dan and Beersheba. And this is at Dan where the altar was, where the shrine was. And so you can actually see that place. but you just can't get away from it. The place just mentioned one time in the Bible in Acts 20 is Assos, and this is on the third journey coming back in. And Paul went on foot ahead as he left Troas. Luke and the others came with a ship and met Paul here in the harbor below. And right there, prominently displayed, was the temple of Athena. The sailors would have seen that. You see, in Acts 20, they would have been coming up from here, and they would have seen that this was an operation in the days of Paul. And oldest script, the Gezer calendar, Hebrew script. This is the oldest portion of Scripture, by the way, that has been found, and it was found in that tomb right there, and that is from Numbers chapter 6, written on silver, rolled into an amulet, and worn about someone's neck, and buried right there. This dates back to the Solomonic temple. Solomon's temple was still standing when that scroll was engraved. And I think that was it. So, I'm sorry, Steve had asked me if we would be able to take questions, and I would love to do that. You see what I was trying to cover, and so I think it's time now to, let me just turn it over to you, take a break here, and